My name is Kimberly Williams. I'm a University of Florida doctoral student in the English department. Today is January the 31st, 2020, and we are at Zora's Place in Eatonville, Florida, and I am speaking with...
Ihama Wachupu.
Awesome. Thank you. And we are here today to discuss Afrofuturism regarding the Zora Neale Hurston Festival and Conference. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how did you get into the world of Afrofuturism?
Well, I write fiction. I write mostly literary fiction, but with some part of it is speculative fiction, but which I call realism, right? Ah. But of course, you know, it's when you write about, you know, the supernatural, ghosts and stuff like that, it's called magical realism. But of course, as an African, it's real life,
yeah.
Right? So that's basically what I do. I used to play chess, professional chess, for 10 years in Nigeria. And I gave it up when it, you know, didn't pay the bills. I don't do it professionally anymore, but I play from time to time. And so, of course, my relationship with Afrofuturism comes from, you know, that speculative aspect. And I did write a story years ago when Gaddafi died. Muammar Gaddafi, the dictator, leader of Libya. And so... and that's how basically how I how I got invited to this festival was through, you know, that story that I published. And the thing about the story is basically it looks at Gaddafi and what he represented to the people.
Okay.
And sort of like how the West played this double-faced game with Gaddafi and with Libya. And basically just, you know, looked at that relationship. Basically looks at Gaddafi's last days in the Syria before he was killed. I just imagined what that was like, but also using that as a platform to get out his double-edged relationship with the West. But sometimes, you know, it was beneficial to the West, and then when it wasn't beneficial anymore, they plotted to take him down. And the problem was that story was that no journal in the West wanted that story.
Okay.
Not here in the US and not in the UK. And eventually got published in South Africa. And then when Bill Campbell put, you know, his anthology together, that's how he found that story, and then he made its way back to the US, which is really very interesting. And so of course it tells you about, you know, how beneficial and important Afrofuturism is.
Yes.
Because what that's doing is it's giving visibility to narratives that are traditionally suppressed in the West.
Okay.
And so you know, and so that's one beneficial aspect of Afrofuturism.
Okay.
And that's basically my relationship with it.
Okay. Yes. And I know in your work there's so much around ghosts and haunting. Can you describe that particular conduit in your work, and why not perhaps, you know, I don't know, vampires or behemoths or?
Of course. I mean, I'm African, I'm Nigerian, and I grew up in that culture where, a witch could be a vampire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Right? Because,
yeah.
You know, witches, and when I talk about witches, I mean, like, in real terms, your neighbor could be a witch back in Nigeria, and then, you know, someone could say, that person living over there is losing a lot of blood because the witch is sucking that person's blood.
Uh-huh.
And in that way, a witch could be a vampire.
Yes.
Right. And so that's, now, as far as culturally within the cosmology of my world as a Nigerian, that's my relationship with vampires.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And of course, the belief in the supernatural and the belief in ghosts, that's something that's also part of my Igbo cosmology as as an Igbo Nigerian.
Okay.
Which is why that's what I grew up with, and that's what I write about. And so even though I'm doing literary fiction,
yeah,
that aspect of my culture has to be part of that fiction.
Okay.
You know, because that's how I express myself in the world. That's how I find myself in the world.
Okay.
For it to be authentic fiction, from my point of view, that has to be a part of the component of making the world the fiction that I create.
Okay. Thank you for that really thorough and very culturally enriching response.
Yes.
And with that, how do you define Afrofuturism?
Afrofuturism, I mean, just beyond being in the section of African culture and science, like I said, I feel like it's a vector for, you know, the dissemination of African culture and the creation of a black utopia. I feel like any story where, you know, doing poverty porn, you know, when we're talking about Africa, where Africans are seen as as occupying a place in the world that is equivalent to other people, that's Afrofuturism. And I go back always to when I was growing up and I was watching, you know, the Star Trek movies, you know, and I love those movies, they're great movies. And I loved this idea of being in the future and seeing what, you know, even though I might not have believed that's what the future might look like, but it was really invigorating and stimulating to see that sort of future. But I just couldn't find myself in that future because of a lot of, you know, white people. And so as a child, and you're growing up as a child, and you're asking yourself, it appears that the future has no place for me. And you see, it's really important for a black child growing up anywhere in the world to be able to see themselves in the future, to feel like they have a voice in the future, to feel like they have a voice in the world, right? And so that became problematic for me. In Lacanian psychology, there's the idea that from the ages of 6 to 18 months, a child recognizes themselves in the mirror. And when that happens, the child then, they're able to accept themselves as an object that that can exist outside of themselves. And from that stage, the idea of the ideal is built. Because so that when a child watches like Superman, that's the ideal. And so instead of seeing Superman, they're seeing themselves as Superman. So when they watch like a commercial and they see someone with white teeth and with a great body, they put themselves in the position of that person. Right. Now, if a black child in the world is watching all of these movies about superheroes and seeing only white people, it starts to affect the confidence of a child growing up, right? And so it's really important that Afrofuturism comes and it's trying to get place at the table, and that's what like Black Panther does, you know, like seeing, I mean, movie like say show like Luke Cage, and then Black Panther, seeing a black superhero is such an important thing for a child, which is why we want to see more movies like that.
Yes.
We want to see more literature like that. We need more support for stuff like that. We need, you know, money pumping. Let's have this elaborate discussion about our lives, you know. And of course, there's a lot of Afrofuturist art. And when you look at that, it's so beautiful when you see all of that art coming out. And I wanted to also mention watching Doctor Who as a child. I love Doctor Who, you know. And I had Doctor Who was really very funny, right? And I had the same problem with Doctor Who. And the problem was that I just didn't see myself in that future. Even as much as I loved that future, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But so that, you know, growing up, And this happens at a subconscious level for a child growing up. Whoever you see as Doctor Who becomes the ideal, and that's what you associate with what you want to be like. And so your role models are not people who look like you, but people who do not look like you, and you eternally. So you basically, it's like you're being programmed. And so you're looking up to, in this situation, white people. Right. And so hopefully Afrofuturism can, you know, entrench its position in the West, you know, which is the epicenter of literary production, and that can help create a new narrative about, you know, Africans, people of African extraction, mm-hmm. and African culture. Mm-hmm. And make it important, you know, make it like a tangible thing.
That's wonderful. You already touched on, and you were talking about the significance and the influence of course, Wakanda Forever with the Black Panther film. Can you describe your feelings and your thoughts about that film and your work?
First, I mean, I have kids, and you know, and it's important for my kids. And last November, I went to my kids' school, and on the wall, I saw a drawing of a pharaoh's queen, and there was a sphinx, and they're all black. Mm-hmm. And seeing that, I took a picture of it and I posted it on Twitter. I'm like, this is so important.
Absolutely.
You know, because you see in depictions of Africans every time in Hollywood, and they're white.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and of course, you sort of go back to the 25th dynasty in Egypt, and how, I mean, the 25th dynasty were, you know, people who are black skin, and when you go to the museum in Egypt, they skip the 25th dynasty,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that sort of erasure, it's something that we continue as black people to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
And Haiti has taught us that it is those who are in charge of the tools of making history that make history and determine the narratives that we live with then as human beings, right? And so what Afrofuturism does, of course, is to allow us to take charge of, you know, the means of producing history. So back to your question about watching Black Panther, it was great. I mean, some of it was referred to like Boko Haram and Nigeria, you know, and you're like, oh yeah, I know that. And just seeing black people in the position of power, seeing the creation of this black utopia was like euphoric, mm-hmm. you know, for me, just watching it, you know. And so, I mean, you're watching people flying around as Superman, like Superman, and you're like, that guy looks like me. I can fly. And the kids are watching it, and you know, my kids are like, you know, 4 and 6, and they're at that stage where, you know, they're making their own impressions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important for them, mm-hmm. at that point to see, you know, people like them flying around. So, you know, for me, it was, you know, it was great just watching that movie, and cathartic too, you know. You feel like, you know, this is something you've always wished for, and to see it happen in your lifetime is really great. As for its effect on my work, I mean, my writing is basically, all my stories are set in Nigeria, you know. What it does is, I mean, every time we have a story about black people, you know, being pushed forward, what happens is that all the stories about black boys begin to gain some kind of prominence.
Mm.
So you see that trickle-down effect, mm. right? And so you have more, you feel like someone is finally listening.
Okay.
And so you want to push yourself out there because you know it's like, now we're finding our voice, you know? So great things, better things might happen out there, because you know, when you push your work out there, you don't know how anyone reacts to it, you know. I was having a talk with Bill yesterday, and he was telling me how he had found my story, and he's like, people online were saying, have you read the story in Jungle Gym? And you know, some people, I mean, I don't even know these guys, and this story was published a long time ago.
Yes.
Right. And so yes, it makes you think that more people are beginning to listen, and perhaps we will gain prominence with this centering of our story, you know,
mm-hmm.
in you know, in the West, you know, and hopefully throughout the world.
Okay. And just as, you know, Afrofuturism has really sort of like became so public with, you know, with the Black Panther, from your perspective, what does Afrofuturism offer society at the moment? What does it offer for critique or liberation or opportunity?
I mean, it's another way of experiencing the world, you know, because, you know, one might be right to say that before this time, there's like this one way of looking at the world, which is, you know, through Hollywood or other avenues of expression that are not controlled by black people. So, so it offers a way to highlight just the fact that, you know, a black utopia is possible. And you see how it galvanized a lot of people when Black Panther came out. A lot of people, you know, people went and bought like African clothes and went to the cinema, and they spent a lot of money, and it showed that if you make a movie and they're all black people and it's great, people are going to go out and watch it regardless of whether they're black or white. You know, people are going to make money. So that, you know, the color of your skin doesn't really, you know, capitalism as a system doesn't really care whether, you know, you're black or white. But, I mean, the thinking before was that if you have only black people in the movie, no one's going to go out and watch it. You know, it's going to tank at the box office. You know, if you don't have like white people there, you know, as like the lead cast, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money. But of course, you know, Black Panther proved that that's not the case. So yes, yeah, so that's basically what I feel. You know, the Black Panther the movie, what it did, you know, by, you know, its existence itself. I forget the other parts of your question.
Oh, so what does Afrofuturism like offer, like, you know, critiques or and liberation opportunities? So you have touched on.
As for liberation, I mean, I want to say something that there's a criticism of Afrofuturism in Africa by certain writers who believe that Afrofuturism only caters to the African-American narrative. I mean, there was a writer in South Africa who was saying that that, you know, she lives in this place and she has her own local problems, and that Afrofuturism isn't going to come and save her. Right. You know, that her story isn't centered, you know, in the Afrofuturism push. And of course, you know, like in the US, Afrofuturism is a way to empower black people. It's empowering black people. Black Panther did seem to empower black people. And while that writer in South Africa might have, like, her grievances might be, you know, legitimate, my counter to that is that anywhere, any story that makes a black person look good always trickles down, right? Because, you know, it always trickles down in different ways.
Yes.
You know, and so, and I was thinking about this like a couple of days ago, about like how, you know, Afrofuturism can be used for liberation. Even, like, for instance, say in Nigeria, where we have a dictator right now as a president, if an artist makes art using that president's face on, say, I don't know, and I'm not prescribing this, but like on like a horse's body as a way to talk about what sort of person that president is, that leads to, you know, it adds to the conversation about what's happening in that country. And so that's a way in which Afrofuturism can, you know, help for those of us in Africa, help get us out of the problems or spark a debate about the state of our affairs, you know, instead of, you know, that's just, I mean, because Afrofuturism has many tracks. You know, so that's, you know, in music we have that, in, you know, we have it, you know, in literature. Arts could be another form of expression, because that person was saying that thing was a writer. Yeah, so, yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you for that thorough answer. And, you know, with that, extend even further, where do you see the relationship, the link between Afrofuturism and Zora Neale Hurston?
You know, when I was a master student at UT, I did my master at UT at the Missioner Center for Writers. I took a class called Haiti and the American imagination, and you know, and learned about, you know, when she went to Haiti and that ethnography, where she, you know, studied the people by becoming part of the people, mm-hmm. right? And so there's something adventurous about her spirit, mm-hmm. and there's a boldness about her, and so there's a boldness about Afrofuturism, and which is part of the spirit of Zora. Just going out, there's no one's going to do it for us. We are going to need to shine a light on ourselves, you know. And the idea of immersing yourself in a culture to study that culture, you know, being part of the voodoo practices in Haiti, mm-hmm. not just, you know, separating yourself from the people the way that maybe other people would separate themselves, yeah. you know, to study them, but being part of that process itself, mm-hmm. that's something that's so unique to Afrofuturism, because, you know, we're immersing ourselves in our own culture and in order to navigate this world and shine a light on ourselves, you know, to change the narrative about, you know, Black people and Black culture, mm-hmm. you know, and Black works.
And do you think the Zora Neale Hurston Festival engagement with Afrofuturism continues Hurston's legacy?
I think it does. Yeah, especially, of course, because of the fact of the of Afrofuturism being a bold vehicle to explore our place in the world. Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, as Black people in America, as Black people around the world, we're yearning for our place in the world, mm-hmm. right? And so that continues her legacy, because basically she was trying, in order to find her place in the world, she had to interact with Black people in other places, mm-hmm. to shine a light, mm-hmm. in order to understand who she was, so that she could find a place in America. Mm-hmm. Right, and so she was yearning, and Afrofuturism is basically Black people yearning to find themselves, mm-hmm. right? And so that's why I think, you know, that conversation, that relationship will continue, because basically we are interested in the same things.
And what do you think contemporary Afrofuturists can learn from Zora Neale Hurston and other early related scholars?
I would say it would be that in order for you to get from one place, like a place of weakness, to a place of strength, mm-hmm. you do have to make some sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And I think, for us as writers, we do have to understand that we're gonna take some hits.
Yeah.
Right, and that we're gonna sacrifice a lot of things. And so looking forward, mm-hmm. we must say to ourselves, in order for us to have a better future, we need to do these things, and sometimes things are gonna be bad, mm-hmm. you know, but hopefully we'll be in a better place in the future. And that's, you know, that the idea that it's not, what we're doing isn't, you know, a cushy, we're not like in a soft, cushy place. Mm-hmm. We're in a place where we're gonna have to make sacrifices. And we have to be bold and make the sacrifice, you know, in order to move forward.
That's true. Yes. So I am thinking about taking your course, but I don't really know too much about Afrofuturism. So what sort of Afrofuturistic mixtape you would give me that would include maybe like 3 to 5 really important sort of snapshots or artifacts of Afrofuturism that you think would be just tremendous for a new beginning author, reader, creator to get into? And it could be across music, art, you know, of course, texts.
Okay, so basically, you know, I mean, I do mostly literary fiction. So this is like my mixtape for,
yes.
you know,
yeah.
what Afrofuturism is. I would say, there's the musician called Fela Kuti.
Yeah.
I would say Fela is like, you know, it's a good jumping off point. There's a lot of art too. I mean, I don't know names right off the top of my head, but like, you know, one could search for a lot of artists who are doing like incredible things.
Yeah.
You know, just visual arts. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that going on. Bill Campbell's, all of his anthologies are great, you know. I would recommend a novel titled An Unkindness of Ghosts by Reva Solomon. Because, it's set in the future, and it clearly shows the intersection between, you know, just black people and science. Let me see. I'm trying to think of this musician. I forget what her name is. But she's always in a lot of Afrofuturist stuff.
Janelle Monae, Erykah Badu.
Yes.
Monet. Okay.
Yes. Yes. She's amazing.
Yes.
She's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's a good example on what she does. You know, she does music, but also when you look at the set, but you watch her videos, just visually what she's
mm-hmm.
doing.
Mm-hmm.
So like, although it's music, it's also like film,
mm-hmm.
and she's doing that all in one shot. Like, you know,
yeah.
you know, she's doing her music video, you see all of the futuristic things she's doing, you know, and it's all black people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Who else? I would say, I think The Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James is like a really excellent book.
Yes.
You know, it's a good book, because, like I said, how I define Afrofuturism is basically just any work that shows black people in a good light,
yes.
you know? And you sort of understand the prognosis of slavery and how, you know, black people really did fight to emancipate themselves. And of course in Haiti, they were successful.
Mm-hmm.
And how that isn't always part of the conversation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you look at Haiti, for instance, you look at the problems that Haiti's had, and you understand how France, you know, countries in Europe, the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
were part of that problem, you know, when the black people emancipated themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that, you know, how they created that trading embargo
mm-hmm.
that allowed Haiti to suffer. And that's, that story doesn't get told enough. And so a lot of people don't know that's why Haiti
yeah.
is where it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, anything that helps, it's useful.
That's right. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. That concludes our interview. Do you have any other last thoughts or comments?
No.
No?
No.
Thank you.
I don't have them. But thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Your work is stunning.
Thank you.
As well as your outfits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.